The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia and to the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation Endowed Lecture. My name is Melissa Grimm. I'm on the board of the foundation and the trustees of the Free Library. And probably like many of you, I'm one of those people that thinks the library is one of the most amazing institutions in the city and the region. We do so many things, from help kids after school to help English second language people find jobs to help cross the digital divide. It's not about just books anymore at the library, and I'm so proud to be a part of this phenomenal organization and so proud to have you all here today. As you saw in the video that aired prior, the Free Library carries our critical work each and every day to advance literacy, guide learning, and inspire curiosity throughout Greater Philadelphia. And with our plethora of online resources, we're bringing our resources to the world. If you value the Free Library as much as I do, please consider making a gift of support through the foundation. The Free Library Foundation makes possible many of the library's incredible programs, including events like today's author series. Please make your donation at freelibrary.org/support. So, it's now my pleasure to introduce the wonderful Jane Pauley. I just had the pleasure of talking with her backstage for a few minutes, along with Tracy Davidson, and she is amazingly authentic, as you feel when you watch her on television. A television broadcasting leader for more than three decades, Jane Pauley co-hosted the Today Show from 1976 to 1989. She anchored Dateline NBC for 11 years, and in 2004 became the host of her own daytime program, The Jane Pauley Show. That same year, she published a memoir, Skywriting, A Life Out of the Blue, in which she extols the self-discovery and revitalization she found at midlife. Miss Pauley has received several Emmy Awards and the prestigious Walter Cronkite Award for Excellence in Journalism. She currently hosts the Your Life Calling segment on the Today Show. In her new book, which we're here to talk about today, also called Your Life Calling, Miss Pauley offers a fresh look at ideas that have been simmering since the baby boomer generation first entered midlife. They did that with a different perspective on the future than any generation had before, with the idea that there's much more to come and perhaps the best of all. And I don't know how many of you feel like I do, but thank God there's more to come after midlife. Michael J. Fox, the celebrated actor, has said of Miss Pauley, "Jane Pauley is a wonderful guide to all the different ways you can open new doors in life, many of which lead to unexpected places. She shows with humor and a great generosity of spirit why the journey to reinvention can come from all kinds of places and produce all kinds of joys." Miss Pauley will be interviewed today by Tracy Davidson, the Emmy Award-winning NBC 10 news anchor and consumer advocate. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Jane Pauley to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Well, look at you, you intrepid souls. I wish I brought my phone out. I'd take a picture of you. That's really great. I see a couple people in the front row I know personally who I will introduce to you at some point during the conversation. We will talk really, really, really fast so that you can get home safely.
So I wanted to begin by telling you publicly what I said to you back there.
You were nervous.
Well, I was nervous. But, of course, look what I do, and look, we're here. This is Jane Pauley. No, I mean, really.
It is Tracy.
Jane Pauley.
This was Tracy. I don't know. Oh, I'm so nervous. She did not.
But I did want to thank you publicly for going before me, for being one that has blazed a trail. And I wanted, we will talk about that, because you say you sort of fell into it. Mm-hmm. But you also said when we just heard Michael J. Fox's name come up, you said, let's talk about that. Mm-hmm. Because you've said that he was one of your favorites to interview, right?
When Melissa mentioned Michael J. Fox, The fact is, my conversation on this topic, it's like puppies in a basket, and you know, one of them starts running away, and then I follow it. And so Michael J. Fox got mentioned and want to tell the story. He plays a role in a couple places in my book. We are not close personal friends, but I did interview Michael J. Fox before you'd ever heard of him. He was not supposed to be the star of Family Ties. You remember Alex P. Keaton? He was just a Canadian kid who's got a sitcom, and within like 15 minutes of the show, a major star was identified. But I would interview Michael every 5 years or so. He'd make a movie, so he went from TV star to the Back to the Future superstar, and then now, of course, we all recognize Michael J. Fox as the icon. He is demonstrating with, how one can live with a difficult diagnosis. He calls Parkinson's the gift that keeps on taking. But nonetheless, talking about a reimagined life, he says, and you totally believe him, that Parkinson's has enabled him to find a better man than he had ever recognized before. So he has had to reimagine his life in ways that most people with Parkinson's could not. I mean, let's say that up front. But he was the final interview I did after 11 years on Dateline. The backstory there was I had made the decision after 11 years that it was time to leave Dateline. Why would anybody voluntarily walk away from a primetime show? I got tons of attention. I got a call from Barbara Walters, who you've heard of. TV Guide called me the poster child for second acts. And a lot of people wanted to know why I had done that. I'll try to keep that long story a little bit short by saying that I would tell everybody that I just had the sense that there was something more for me. Though I recognized leaving television that it probably would look like less, and that I didn't know what that more was, but I wouldn't know until the television camera got out of the way. And so it was kind of a convoluted explanation, but everybody got it. Everybody got it. So NBC starts to plan a testimonial. Jane Pauley signs off for me that spring, and Michael called NBC and volunteered, "Can I be Jane's final interview?"
Wow.
And it was during that interview, the story's going to split into two parts. During that interview, I asked Michael one of my convoluted questions that started with, you've got Parkinson's, we all know that, but yet in the last year you've raised millions for Parkinson's research, you've written a book, you've written a pilot for a television show, you and your wife have had a fourth child. If it was me, I would be relaxing and taking it easy and conserving my energy. And he said to me, not knowing that NBC, because of all the attention I had, Barbara Walters calling, TV Guide, I've already done that, because of all the attention, I became too valuable to let go. So they had secretly, quietly, confidentially offered me an opportunity to do a daytime television show, which was definitely more, not less. So I was debating. I hadn't decided whether to do this or not. There was the fact that I would be opposite Oprah.
That's a detail.
But I was still kind of dithering whether I would say yes or no to this otherwise unknown offer. Michael's response to my question, statement, whatever it was, about conserving my energy was, "And what would you be conserving your energy for?" And it was like, ping. I that was when I decided I would say yes. The daytime show was, yes, it was television, but I'd never done any television like that before. I'd always had an ensemble. I'd always had partners. I'd never worked with a live audience, never had a show with my name on it, which and the responsibility that that implies to a staff of people and so forth. And at that moment, I knew I would say yes. Fast forward about 9 years. It was last spring, and Dateline remained on the air without me and was celebrating a 20th anniversary. And they asked if I would reprise. How do you pronounce that word, librarians? Whatever. Google it later. That interview I had done. So I had an opportunity to ask Michael, why did you do that, volunteer to be my last interview? And he said, because you had been there for so many important events in my life, I wanted to be there for one of yours. You know, one of the events that I shared with him but didn't realize it, I went down to interview him for a movie he was making in Florida called Doc Hollywood. And it was on the set of that movie that he first recognized that tremor in his pinky finger that was later, years later, identified as Parkinson's. He didn't tell me that. I didn't know. But during this reprise interview that I did last spring, we talked about his positive attitude, and I said, do you have to work at that, or does that just come naturally for you? And he said, he just said, you know, say yes more than no. No doesn't move you forward. And that rang another bell with me. I think it was Kim's phone that just went off. Am I right? Okay. Kim Sedmak came up from Washington. Good luck getting home. Kim, wave at the folks. Kim is the executive producer of the Your Life Calling segment that we've done for 4 years on today. And Kim was the person who most often asked me, you know, can you go here? Can you do this? Would you do this? And I started saying, absolutely, sure, yep. And I wondered if she had noticed this change where I wasn't saying no as much. I wasn't saying, let me think about it. I was, before I had a chance for all the reasons why I didn't want to do something to line up, I just said, yes. And that's because Michael J. Fox said, say yes more often as you can, because no doesn't move you forward. And so he's in, not just on the back of my book, with that wonderful thing he says. I'm very flattered. They ought to sell the book backwards. Michael J. Fox liked it. But he's in the book, and that's why I've told you those stories.
So I know part of reimagining for you, you say go back and look at nuggets in your life. So can you go back and tell us how you fell into your career? Because one would think if they didn't know, you had it all planned out, because look at the success that you accomplished.
Yes. This applies to everyone. The story of how Jane Pauley's television career got started is actually has relevance to everybody. Because very few of us really chose our paths in life. I mean, unless you know, were a musical prodigy or, you know, had a calling, you know, for the ministry or something as a child. You know, most of us fell into our career paths for many of your individual reasons, and I did too. But I think I really owe my career in television to the great disappointment, the only passion in life I really would ever have identified with, and I didn't tell people this because it would have been embarrassing when I was younger, but I'll confess it to you, was cheerleading. starting in the sixth grade, I just wanted to be a cheerleader, and I was seventh, eighth, and ninth grade. All my dreams came true. And then in the 10th grade, when we moved to high school, reality struck. Hard, harsh, cold, and cruel. I had been an enthusiastic but mediocre cheerleader. And with weekends free in perpetuity, I was available to discover something I was completely unaware of. My high school in Indianapolis was kind of on a, you know, working class side of Indianapolis, where a lot of my friends had lunch bucket dads, and which paid great property taxes. So it was a very good school. And we had, I discovered, the biggest and the best speech and debate program in the state of Indiana, which I'd never heard of. And my sister and best friend Judy joined the team, and I went to an event and discovered, while I had been a mediocre cheerleader, I was a champion in extemporaneous speaking. And our ribbons and trophies are very reinforcing. So even though after college I did not have a degree in journalism, and the man who hired me, who himself was a news director at Wish TV in Indianapolis, told me that when he hired me, he had never interviewed, much less hired, anyone who had neither a journalism degree or experience in journalism, and I did have neither. And I think that the reason my career started was because I had been, at the age of 15, a speech and debate champion, and talking about current events, in 7 minutes, you'd think I knew what I was talking about. And if there was a better preparation for doing an interview on the Today Show 10 years later, I can't think of it. So there was that, and the fact that I finished college in 1972, which happened to be, no credit to me, the year the FCC added two words to an affirmative action clause that applied to television station licensing. And those two words were "and women." So it didn't guarantee that I was going to be the winner of that job. And years later, Lee told me that actually he had seen 200 applications for the job that he gave to me. But he, even without experience, later told me, and now I'm bragging and boasting, but I'm 63 and I'm
You're
over
loud.
Another thing, that he went up and told the general manager that, no, she doesn't have any experience. I had agreed to work for $100 a week. But he said, if we hire her, I think you should know I don't think we'll keep her very long. Because he recognized, you know, something.
And they didn't, because then Chicago and then Today Show at what, 24, 25?
I was 25, but, I was sometimes, I'm described as having replaced Barbara Walters. Nobody replaces Barbara Walters. I occupied the chair that she vacated when she went to join Harry Reisner on the ABC Evening News and got more attention, drew the spotlight off me, because she was America's first million-dollar anchor, and that was big news. So I quietly, at 25, sit down. Tracy, I was 1 year, almost to the day, from signing off from Wish TV's Big News, the weekend edition, when I occupied the desk at the Today Show. That was inexplicable to me at the time. Now I can sort of explain it, but it was still like a game of chutes and ladders, you know, where it was a lucky roll of the dice. And that said, it would have been very easy for me to come and go real fast. I had a contract written in 13-week cycles which I compare to speed dating. And yet I stayed on the Today Show for 13 years. I grew up and bonded, you know, with a lot of you in the audience. We grew up together. We started our families, you know, together. You know, you'd look at me and think, oh, Jane didn't get much sleep last night, or Jane's not having such a good hair day. And, you know, there's something different about morning television. It's a more intimate relationship. And in those days, you didn't have the competition that Tracy has. People, you know, can check their phone, they can turn on the TV, or, you know, log on to their, you know, just, there are so many different places to get information. When I was on the Today Show, Good Morning America didn't exist yet when I'd arrived. And CBS tried to have morning shows, but really we had no competition. It was one thing. So millions of people were watching and watching me grow up and have a family. And
well, right, and that's part of you being such an inspiration, and you mentioned it, because you were able to bond with the audience because they got to see, I mean, you were a very public working mom at a time when working moms were just trying to sort of get their footing, right?
Well, I was a big, kind of a Debbie Downer, to be honest, you know, back in the having it all days. That conversation's kind of cycling back, and another generation of women is still trying to figure it out. But I was just, I'm supposed to give a short speech in Miami this week if I get down there. And there's a section in the speech where I tell about having been invited in my late 30s to address the class, graduating class at Radcliffe. And I told them that my definition, and I was invited to talk about women's issues in the 90s and having it all. That was the invitation. And I said, my definition of having it all was guilt, burnout, and stress. And women often quote me back to myself, women, you know, of my generation. I would say, and I don't know if it was original to me, but I did say it a lot, you can have it all, but not at the same time. Or I'd say, you know, pick two out of three. You know, a career, family, and social life. Mm-hmm. I had no social life. But in this speech I'm giving in Miami, I made a remark, I will make a remark to them, that you can have it all, but not at the same time. What this book is really about, though I think there's information for anyone who is at any kind of transition, be it a career transition or a midlife transition, whatever, I'm really talking to our generation and to those men and women, but mostly women, that I was talking to about not all at the same time. It's our time. Our children, you know, maybe your children are still at home. Maybe they've come back home. you know, maybe you're looking after aging parents, as so many of us are or have. But my small children are kidults, as my friend Katie calls them. The twins have turned 30. I've got two weddings coming up this year. Very exciting. My daughter knows I'm in Philadelphia because she just graduated from UPenn Law. I'm real familiar with 30th Street Station, so she loves Philadelphia. So she knows I'm here. Nobody else in the family, they've got their own lives. There was a research study from Purdue University in Indiana. I would be proud of that, except that they were the arch rivals of Indiana University, which is my alma mater. But this research found that busy families are happier, they report, because they speculate. Busy people have less time to meddle in each other's lives. So it is my time to come to Philadelphia with no guilt, you know, no sense of, but I'm needed at home, or I was traveling last week. You know, I do feel a little bad about the cats, because I've been traveling a lot this month, and I have two cats, and that suitcase has been open too much. But other than that, I am free to answer the question of, you know, what would I, given an opportunity, be doing now? That when I was a younger woman, I would have, and I had opportunities that most people didn't have, but they made me feel guilty, burned out, and stressed. It's my time, it's our time. And that's what this book is about.
And I love all the stories, because it's all different ways that people are able to find what belongs in my time, that they might not have been able to figure out what belongs in my time earlier in their life. And you have one story in here that's actually local to Philadelphia.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I do?
You do.
Barbara Chandler Allen. You're intrepid. You come up here today. Would you kind of wave so the people can... No, turn around. Stand up. I want you to see who I'm going to be talking about. You're just gorgeous, but this is Barbara Chandler Allen. And she is of Philadelphia, so you can share in the pride of her story. The stories that I tell, I try to keep them pretty reality-based. My goal is not to astonish you with, you know, who knew? I mean, there are some astonishing stories. What Barbara has accomplished is pretty astonishing, but not so that you would feel too intimidated to imagine yourself reimagining a life in any way you want to. But here's what Barbara did. And she didn't set out to reimagine it. She didn't set out to do this. Her reinvented life kind of tapped her on the shoulder or spun her around before she recognized... Thank you. Before she did that, is how it happened. I'll try to tell a little bit about Fresh Artists, which is, as Barbara put it, you know, everybody looks for a way to, you know, to contribute to public education. The schools need so much. And she found a way, working with her younger son, Roger, who also lives here in Philadelphia, to make children in Philadelphia public schools a part of the solution. Barbara's background was in art. She's my generation. College was a bore. She split. She came to Philadelphia in a little red Volkswagen, got a job at the museum. In art, so her background is in art and museums. But for 20 years, she was a stay-at-home mom. The kind I say in the book that don't stay home. If there is a theme, and people often ask, are there any themes that you've noticed of people who reinvent themselves? One of them is people who have a history of volunteering seem to find making transitions easier. And Barbara is a big... Well, I can do that. I could do that kind of person. So she volunteered a lot, and she volunteered in her son's school. And with her background in art, and I'm leaving out parts of the story because, you know, she, I hope, will one day write her own story. But she and her son, who enrolled in a charter school that was new and needed a lot, it was in a converted office building in Philadelphia, a kind of a grim situation. They decorated the halls of the school to look like an art museum. I mean, Barbara would, she knew who to call. Can we borrow? Do you have any of this? Do you have any? And she made it look like a design museum, she and her son. So she's on the phone, she's in a car one day, and she hears that Philadelphia's got a new school superintendent. And he's on being interviewed on the radio. And she's liking what she's hearing, but what he's going to do when he comes to Philadelphia. She pulls off and calls in, gets on the line, and invites her, come and see my school. And he did. And, you know, I think his socks were knocked off. Okay, so Time passes. He remembers this Barbara Chandler Allen character. She's not easy to forget. Her personality is big. And he had a big education center, the old Annenberg building where our TV guides were produced, 800,000 square feet. And he wanted it decorated. He wanted it decorated, and he wanted her to do it, 800,000 square feet. She's not a designer. She's not a decorator. Why have you come to ask me to do this, she would wonder. Because you are a placemaker. A placemaker, a term you'd never heard before, I've never heard before, Barbara never heard before. What did that mean? He said, you know how to make places, you know, come alive. It was a word she'd never heard, but it kind of identified for the first time a very special thing she did. You know, I've already said, and many of you could very easily say, well, I'm not this and I'm not that. What am I? So she knew what she wasn't. She wasn't a designer. She knew what she wasn't. That was a decorator. She had this kind of background in art, but it was way in the background because I've said she was a stay-at-home mom. So her resume, you know, was useless. But he saw talent and gave it a name. And I think you're so fortunate if you have a talent and you have a name. When I'm finished talking about Barbara, would you ask me about Gladys?
Sure.
And I want to come back to that.
Love this.
I want to revisit that idea. Okay, so start decorating this 800,000 square foot thing with children's art, you know, children, you know, refrigerator art. And Barbara realizes it would look like fly specks in this humongous space. And her son Roger had had some experience in digital photography, where you can take a photograph and blow it up, you know, many, many times. And Roger had the idea, well, you know, we could enlarge it. He told me, you know, my mom's really good at asking for stuff. So they went to local architectural photography, digital photography, and they found who would do it, do the work for them, and donate the work. And they started hanging little art, only, you know, this big, and it was astonishing. Long story short, it dawns on them finally, because everybody always wants to buy it. You know, they're like, wow, where can I get you? It's not for sale. It's not for sale. Until they look at each other one day and realize we're on to something. And the concept behind Fresh Artists is this. A corporation like Blue Cross of Philadelphia, where we shot the story with Barbara, will make a donation, in fact, really the substantial, a check to Fresh Artists, and as a thank you for the donation to Fresh Artists, which supports arts in the public schools of Philadelphia, they get a thank you of one of these pieces of art that hangs in Blue Cross. So the money goes to the schools, the corporations get this amazing, it really is visually astonishing art. It's a win-win-win. Now, I'm going to transition away from Barbara's story in just a moment. Barbara talks about having a basket of pals. She's really good at giving people advice. On like me, I give advice, but she's really good at it. And having a basket of pals is what Kim Sedmak represents for me. When I was looking for reinvention, I didn't want a boss, but not as much as I wanted not to be a boss. I wanted to work with partners. I wanted to work in a group. And our team at AARP, Kim is the executive producer of the Your Life Calling segment, but I invented it. It was my idea. I have a basket of pals. And I think when we sometimes look at reimagining our lives, it feels so scarifying and isolating. And unless you looked at it as something that you might not do yourself, but do with. You know, we can't all have the personality and the stamina and charisma of a Barbara Chandler Allen who has all those things. But you probably could imagine working with her and being one of her basket of pals and having a reimagined life like that. The other thing that Barbara said apropos of this message is, I've always been a pretty confident person, but in my 60s, it's reached terrifying proportions. And I don't know if my confidence has reached terrifying proportions, but I am a far more confident person. I am a risk-taking person. I mean, when you've gone up against Oprah and failed, it was my show. My daytime show was exciting. I had a theme song. I did. If my daughter was here, she'd sing it for you. I never remember what it is. But it was very exciting, but it failed. I am prouder of that failure on my resume than almost anything else, because it said, I look at myself. She was a person who tried. I have the confidence to try things I might fail at, because been there, done that. And it felt good to have the courage to try something. Maybe I'm being perverse, and maybe you don't identify with that. Maybe the idea of trying and failing is frightening to you. But I don't think I'm that unusual. Or maybe I've just, I hope, given you permission to try and fail and say, well, I don't know, Jane Pauley did too. And then she got up again. I think as a parent, one of the most greatest gifts I've given my children, whose mother was on television and whose father had his current job as a cartoonist before he left college. We are, as role models, ridiculous. But modeling failure was great for them. Was great. Now, would you ask me who Gladys was?
Yeah, and we will. And we will. We have a couple more minutes after we hear who Gladys is that you'll have an opportunity to ask questions.
Okay, so
who's Gladys?
The last time... Okay. So, I've told lots of... There are lots of Barbara stories. Not Barbara stories, but other Barbaras and Bobs. And there are dozens of stories in here. Each different. Each with a nugget that I hope will make your brain sparkle. But being on a book tour, my husband calls me a book tourist, has enabled me to meet people one-on-one, signing books, and I hope before we escape into a nor'easter, I can meet some of you and hear some haiku versions of your life reimagined. Gladys was a woman when I walked into St. Louis to a reception, and there were three women sitting right by the door as I entered, all of them elderly women. So I stopped to say hello. One of them was in a wheelchair, and they were all over 90, and it was a Saturday night in St. Louis. The polar vortex was gone, but it was darn cold. Later, Gladys, with her cane, strides up to me and says, how might someone 96 reimagine her life?
Nice.
And Gladys went on to, she explained that she had redecorated her room. I don't know, assisted living possibly, but she had gone modern this time, not classical. And Gladys stayed on my mind, and I kind of punted her question. I didn't really have an answer for it. But she stuck with me, and I want to get back to her because as I thought about it, Gladys, at 96, clearly was a woman with a gift for living. And more than that, a gift for sharing her gift for living. I thought of those other two women that I found her sitting with, and especially the quiet woman in the wheelchair. And I'm wondering how often Gladys gets her to get dressed up and go out on a Saturday night to hear an author lecture in St. Louis. If I could tell Gladys, you have the gift for living and for sharing your gift for living, that's how a woman in her 90s reimagines her life. It's like being, it's something Gladys, if I told Gladys, it would not be a revelation. She'd know exactly what I meant. But just as Barbara knew what a placemaker was without really having had it defined, until she was told, you are a placemaker, she didn't know. Gladys, if I were able to tell her, you have a gift for living and for sharing that gift for living, would validate this gift of hers and probably, in affirming it, give her more confidence when she wakes up tomorrow morning. How will I share my gift for living today? And that is reimagining your life.
And that speaks to your gift that your sister said, you said in the book that she told you that you help people see themselves in powerful and positive ways. What a great gift.
And my husband says, I don't know when to stop talking.
Well, we love that, so that's fine. Questions?
Yes.
Thank you.
I can't believe so many. I was prepared to, you know, for 15 of us to have a little get together. Look at all of you who came out today. I'm so grateful. I see a hand up on the aisle. You see up there? Probably don't really need the microphone, but make sure everybody can hear.
You are just wonderful, Jane.
Thank you.
Of all the interviews you've done, I know you spoke about Michael Fox. Is there anyone else that stands out or maybe hit you in the gut or that you could elaborate and tell us about?
Me and Madonna weren't that good together. you remember the worst and the best. If Michael was the best, and I think if Madonna were here, and she's glad she's not, she would agree. We were not a good match. I interviewed a nurse, and it never made the air. She had been a nurse who served in Vietnam, and the story that she told about her experiences being a nurse, like in a MASH unit during Vietnam, and the other nurses who served without a lot of recognition, was one of the most memorable interviews I've ever done, and it never made the air. It got cut. But she told me something. This is interesting, how, you know, the way we look at ourselves, how we identify ourselves is, sometimes our sibling experience, we never get over it. But most of the time, by the time you reach 60, you can't remember why you thought, you know, your sister was the only one who could do that when, you know. But she told me that a dramatic proportion, percentage of the nurses in Vietnam were firstborn daughters from big Catholic families. And they had the angel complex. They needed to save people. And I've kind of never let go of that image. Firstborn daughters of big Catholic families trying to save people.
That's nice. Any other questions?
Yes.
My name's Susan Collins. I'm the executive director for the Transition Network. So
hi.
It's
yes.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
And all of our TTNers here were.
Yeah, y'all should look them up. A Google Transition Network when you get home, and you might find a basket of pals there.
That's what I was going to say. I absolutely love the basket of pals because that's what I feel like we are. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to ask you, in all of the interviews that you've done on women who are men and women reimagining their lives, have you found any consistent characteristics that helped them get through that transition and really find some meaning in their lives?
That's really what I was trying to boil down in the 15 minutes they give me in Miami. because the big one, one of them that I've told is volunteering. My friend Katie, who coined the phrase "kidults," said that she had read that people who volunteer in their 30s develop a kind of muscle memory for volunteering. And so having a history of volunteering is one. People who have a lot of hobbies and outside interests. Mm-hmm. An advertising executive once told me once, I can never retire because I have no outside interests. And I kind of could relate because I am not a person with a long list of hobbies and outside interests. People who enjoy learning things. There's a category of people who aren't intimidated at the prospect of signing up for a course or have gone back to college. And I've interviewed some who admitted they did so with some trepidation until they quickly figured out that while they might have been a decade, 2 or 3 years older than anybody else in the class, they were far more likely to have done the homework. But being a person who likes to learn new things doesn't necessarily mean signing up for a course. It means you are available to, with your curiosity, develop a skill set that might enable you to, in combination with everything that you've done in life already, you all have skills, you all have experiences. You may not think of them. If you had a basket of pals, you probably would have people who could help you. Say, are you kidding? Why do you think people always come to you when? So, but maybe there's something that you would be eager to try, but for the absence of a credential or knowing how to do something or knowing how to do something at a level that people would pay you to do it, you might have to learn a little bit more. There are people who are open to that. I'm not in that category so much either. And yet, I was troubled in writing these remarks from Miami. What category? You know, how do you explain me? And I think that there isn't a limit to the number of qualities that people possess that enable them to be good at this. There are some that are obvious. But Kim sent me, she's always sent me story ideas. Our story ideas, AARP, I have to like them. Kim has to like them. AARP has to like them. The Today Show has to like them. Everybody has to like them. So she sends me story ideas. And it was Doug Smith, the T'Pau? Okay. So she sends me this story about, I've never met the man, never heard of him, was the head of a big food company when he was diagnosed with a slow but incurable form of cancer. And he immediately resigned, you know, thinking he needed the space. Mistake. You know, escaping was not what he wanted. Well, he started to think, and he thought maybe with his background in business he could teach. He could teach a course in leadership, he thought. And as he did his research, he was quite taken with a book he read on a different topic but related, happiness. Long story short, he went to Kim's alma mater at DePauw University in Indiana, where once in the winter term, he teaches what has become a really popular course in the Skills for Happiness. And Kim, he described me to myself. Kim and I have not talked about this. He talked about some of the skills of happy people, and I recognized that I had some of this ability, and I didn't bring them with me, and I've got the memory of an Etch-a-Sketch, so you know, bear with me as I try to fumble through why I identified. One of them was an ability to look at the past, its challenges, its disappointments, acknowledge them, learn from them, and move on. I got that. Another was an ability to look at the future, not knowing what the future holds, for good or bad, but yet with an attitude that whatever comes, I'll probably be able to work with it. I got that. And the third, he talked about, and with something about peace about the past and confidence in the future, you are free to live in the present where joy is found. That's pretty much what he said. And I'm a little fuzzy on the present thing. I definitely live in the future. But there is a question that somebody might have asked, so let's pretend they just did. Are there any gender differences, Jane, that you have discovered? Tom Brokaw interviewed me at the 92nd Street Y in New York City last week, with an audience like you. And he asked me the gender differences question. And I told him it was interesting. Tears. Five, if not six, of the men that I've interviewed have cried tears of regret. I've had tears from women, but it's tears over a memory, a loss. But from the men, it was tears, why have I only now found this precious something? Why couldn't I have found it earlier in my life? Am I right? So after the interview, I got a handwritten note from Paul Giannone, who was in the book. He was in the audience that night. And his note said to me, Jane, didn't you know those were tears of joy? Mm-hmm. And I just melted. But I do think that I am growing into this present that Doug Smith referred to. In a way, earlier in my life, I was always half in the future. I'm a worrier. You know, my kids are getting married. I can't wait to have grandchildren. I'll worry about them. You know. But more, and I think this comes with age. I don't think that this is me evolving or me, you know, maturing in a special way. I think it just is more typical of as you round 50, mm-hmm. You know, there's science on this that shows that at the age of 50, the trend, it starts trending up. Feelings of wellness mm-hmm. and satisfaction improve, and they keep on getting better. And, you know, the good news there is that whether you are 50 yet or not, you're going to be. And that one thing that we all have in common with our children and our grandchildren is that we're going to be living the rest of our lives in the future. What are you going to do?
Terrific. We have time for one more question, and then let's get out of here and go into the snow. One more question.
I can't.
Okay. You mentioned that this new generation of young people are facing some of the things that you faced mm-hmm. when you were young. What advice would you give to them?
And do I give them advice? Yes, I do. What we call reinvention, my kids, my millennials, will call the churn. 20-somethings I've read will have 8 jobs on average before they turn 30. And yet, individually, they're feeling the same thing we're feeling. Other people got it together. You know, they're already, you know, up and running, and I'm still bumping up against the wall. And, you know, you always feel like you're the one who didn't get the invitation to this party. And that's just not true. Trial and error applies to them, and it applies to us. They think
they have to get it right the first time because they'll screw up their whole lives, you know, if they pick the wrong major, you know, or if they take the wrong job, or if I quit my job, I'll never get another one. We think, well, at this stage in life, I can't afford to make a mistake. It's got to be perfect. That's not true for either of us. Trial and error is the way to go. With intelligence, you know, taking time to, you know, ascertain whether the field that you're thinking about is already overcrowded. Do you genuinely have an affinity for it, a proficiency? What could you do to make yourself more marketable with this thing? Both generations should be aware of having an idea and taking it to abstraction. If you've ever heard a young person say, well, I'm going to be a screenwriter. Have you ever written a screenplay? No. But the idea that I'm going to be a screenwriter has been, they've heard themselves say it so often, they think they are. That can happen in our age group as well, where we have an idea, I'm gonna, until we forget we aren't, and we don't take steps. So actively be engaged in a process of exploration with a little bit of drift is fine. It can take time. Bumping into something and failing, back up, try it again a different way or try something else. So, you know, there is a lot of advice here that would be appropriate for millennials if they would put up with listening to me.
And mine don't. Why would yours?
But the Gen Xers, and though I think boomers are the only generation that really has a generational identity, but the Gen Xers are turning 50 in February. And I've been interviewed by a number of reporters of that age group in their 40s, and they say, I've heard this over and over again, this is all we talk about. So there's a lot of people in the basket.
Well, thank you for spending time with Philadelphia.
Thank you for coming out. Thank you so
read
much.
Read the book if you haven't read the book. It's terrific, and it does make your brain sparkle. It's terrific. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.